And, of course, Bhagavad Gita gives the supreme education. So I was quite surprised, not surprised, but quite happy to see that, that people would actually seriously consider such a thing. Even if they didn't take the book, they would, yes, maybe I should try to get over there. It's one thing, perhaps in their minds, to go to a workshop or a discussion and learn something. And it's another thing to kind of partake in religion. So many times it gives them a very good excuse that, well, I'm going there to learn a great book, one of the great classics of literature. I'm going there to engage in a seminar or workshop about it. I'm not going there for, you know, any, you know, to become converted or anything like that. So I was quite satisfied to see that quite a few people, they expressed a desire in that way, to be able to go somewhere and hear and discuss Bhagavad Gita. Of course, it's necessary that, first of all, our own devotees, they know Bhagavad Gita. At least one book we should know very thoroughly in Krishna consciousness. And if you can make Bhagavad Gita come alive for the people, they very much are attracted to that. And then certainly they'll want to get a Bhagavad Gita for themselves, because they're seeing how you are so fascinated by the book yourself that they also think, yes, there's a good chance if I get this book, I'll also become fascinated. Because as any material salesman will tell you, people, when they're buying things, they're buying expectations. They're not buying the thing itself. They're buying expectations of what the thing will do for them. So when they see you so fascinated by Bhagavad Gita, they are thinking that, yes, there's a chance that I, when I get this book, I'll also be able to become fascinated in the same way. And I'll also be able to be absorbed in a way that could be very nice. So it's necessary for our devotees, at least out of all our books, to know Bhagavad Gita in a way that makes it come alive for the people. And of course, the more devotees try to engage people in taking Bhagavad Gita seriously, the more devotees will be able to relish Bhagavad Gita themselves. People have brains, and there's still some of those brains left in Kali Yuga, and Bhagavad Gita is especially meant for their intelligence. Their intelligence has never and will never see anything like Bhagavad Gita. And if you can present it to them in that way, that this is what your brain is thirsty for. And they also like you as a devotee, and then naturally they'll want to take this book seriously. So I've been told we're on chapter 3, text 1. This chapter is entitled Karma Yoga. Now, what has happened in the preceding chapters? As you recall, chapter 1 sets the scene. Arjuna riding out in between the two armies, becoming covered with illusion, and then breaking down and saying, Krishna, I will not fight, because there's no way any good can come out of this. There's no way anybody's going to be happy. There's no way I'll be happy doing this, therefore I cannot partake in it. And of course, Krishna proceeded to correct Arjuna, and his first correction was based on analytical knowledge of the difference between the body and the self. And Krishna urged him, don't be overcome by temporary dualities, by temporary comings and goings of happiness and distress. become situated in the real self. And so in the second chapter, Krishna gives Arjuna a very analytical presentation of matter and spirit, and how Arjuna should use his intelligence, buddhi yoga, and in this way save himself from unnecessary lamentation, save himself from unnecessary confusion, and in this way Arjuna could be firmly situated on a platform that he could make spiritual advancement on. As Prabhupada said so many times, the knowledge of the second chapter is the ABCs of spiritual life. Knowing that you're not the body, that is simply the beginning of spiritual life. Yet we see that Srila Prabhupada spent so much time in lectures trying to convince people they were not the body, letting you know that people are desperately needing even this preliminary knowledge. I remember once in Bombay, Srila Prabhupada was for the umpteenth time explaining to some visitors how they were not matter but spirit, and coming up with his usual allegories, and also bringing up new ones. And then afterwards, he turned to the devotees there, I think one of them was Giriraj Swami, and some other devotees, and Prabhupada said, "Do you think that these things just come to me?" He said, "No, I'm always thinking about how to present these things. So don't think that I just pull them out of the thin air. I'm always thinking at every moment how to present this subject matter of you're not the body." So, Prabhupada giving us insight into what it takes to impress people with Krishna consciousness. It takes an absorption, always analyzing how the people can understand the message. So, now we've moved into chapter 3, entitled Karma Yoga. You see, Bhagavad Gita gives you a compendium of various types of yogas. That may sound a little mysterious at first, because even as devotees, when we think of yoga, we think of bodily exercises. But actually, yoga means to link with the Supreme. Just like even the word religion comes from the Latin educar, which means to connect. So religion and yoga, they're very close in terms of their original meanings. So there are different kinds of yogas explained in Bhagavad Gita. Sankhya yoga, how to analyze the material world, see it in all its different facets, and get to the root. Then there's karma yoga, how to perform activities in such a way that at least some of the results are for Krishna. Then there's jnana yoga, beyond simply seeing that you're not the body. Jnana yoga means understanding the all-pervasive spiritual oneness, that manifestation of Krishna known as the impersonal Brahman. Through your intellect, understanding that everything is Brahman. And there's Jhana Yoga, the yoga of meditation on the Super Soul, through various asanas and various breathing disciplines, how to become so calm and so still that you can become aware of the Super Soul in the heart. There's so many misunderstandings that just like I was reading in one yoga teacher in Christchurch, she was talking about how yoga is not what people think it is. Actually, yoga is not, it's non-denominational, it's not religious. It actually puts you in the situation in which you can get to the heart of all religion. And she said, the heart of all religion is the silence that's deep within. That is not the heart of all religion. It's not that we want to become silent. Silence in the yoga system is for the purpose of being able to see and hear the Super Soul. Otherwise, ordinary silence, there's no big deal to that. Of course, people have no knowledge even of what the real purpose of Hatha Yoga and Ashtanga Yoga or Pranayama is for. They just use these words on the bodily platform. But in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Jnana Yoga, these things are explained. That when the mind is controlled and peaceful, then the super soul is already reached. For one who has attained mental tranquility, the super soul is already reached. That means if the super soul is not reached, one has not obtained mental tranquility. And Prabhupada writes in the purport of that verse some very nice points. That if a devotee somehow or other fixes his mind on the spiritual energy of Krishna through the processes of devotional service, then automatically there'll be dictation from the super soul because your mind has been fixed on the devotional energy. And then I realized, upon reading that, this is the result of a solid Krishna conscious devotional program, that your mind is automatically fixed on the spiritual energy, and therefore dictation from the super soul, whether you're conscious of it or not, automatically follows. That's the wonder of Prabhupada's system of devotional engagements. And that's why devotees who, under guidance, take the standard temple format of devotional service very seriously, that's why they do have a better chance. Not to say that anybody who doesn't live in close proximity and close connection with the devotional community, it doesn't mean that automatically they're out of it. No, by no means. But the fact is that Prabhupada very ingeniously devised a system of devotional activities in which your mind would be caught up in Krishna, and therefore, whether you know it or not, you would be receiving dictation from the super soul how to please Krishna better. So, all these different yogas, Sankhya, Dhyana, Karma, Dhyana, they're all culminating in Bhakti. Because Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of pure love and devotion, has elements of all the other yogas in it. Prabhupada describes that you can imagine a yoga ladder, and when you take different facets and analyze them on their own, then you come up with things like Jnana and Dhyana and Sankhya and Karma yogas. But when you see them all for the purpose that they're meant for, the ultimate purpose, then you call it Bhakti. So it is not true that Bhakti yoga has no knowledge. People have that misunderstanding. They think, oh, you're following Bhakti, the yoga of love and devotion. That means you guys, you don't know that much. You just have good sentiments. People think like that, but they can't even understand Bhagavad Gita, which is our basic book. What to speak of Srimad Bhagavatam and then Chaitanya Charitamrita. So this is chapter 3, Karma Yoga. Let us recall what Krishna told Arjuna at the end of the second chapter. Krishna told him, that is the way of the spiritual and godly life, after attaining which a man is not bewildered. If one is thus situated, even at the hour of death, one can enter into the kingdom of God. So the whole second chapter was to teach Arjuna how to become properly situated. And then once Arjuna had basic information how to be properly situated, then Krishna was going to teach him more. You know what's coming up ahead. The fourth chapter, there'll be knowledge of Krishna's appearance into this world. The seventh chapter, there'll be knowledge of the Absolute, how to see Krishna in everything. In the tenth chapter, there'll be the opulences of the Supreme, so on and so forth. So first, though, Arjuna had to be properly situated on a platform on which he could get instruction with an unagitated mind. It's very important to deal with Krishna consciousness with an unagitated mind. Just like Sunday we were speaking about on Mother's Day, how Prahlad Maharaj and his mother both heard Krishna consciousness from Narada Muni. Prahlad was within his mother's womb, and he heard Narada Muni speaking Bhagavad Dharma. Now, what I didn't say on Sunday was that Prahlad remembered everything, even though he was within the womb, but the mother forgot. Why did his mother forget? Because she was in anxiety. Where is my Hiranyakashipu? Where is my husband? Will he return home safely? So she was in such anxiety that she could not remember Narad Muni's instructions, but Prahlad did. And therefore, even at 5 years of age, Prahlad was teaching his schoolmates about Bhagavad Dharma. So, it's very important to be properly situated, having a peaceful mind so that one can hear and learn. And so much of our Krishna conscious regimen or schedule is to create a situation whereby devotees have peaceful minds and they can listen. That is the beginning purpose, a preliminary purpose of a Krishna conscious center, to give the devotees a facility and advice how to have peaceful minds so they can hear clearly. Otherwise, as everybody knows, the material world is a very rough and tumble place. There's no doubt there are austerities living in temples and Krishna conscious communities. No doubt. Prabhupada himself gave the example that he said there's an old Bengali proverb: when you have a bunch of kitchen utensils together, naturally there's going to be some noise. So similarly, you pack a building with all sorts of persons coming from different backgrounds, and naturally sometimes they rub each other the wrong way and they lose their patience a bit. But still, no matter what anybody says, the little turbulence and turmoils and routine misunderstandings that go on in temple life cannot compare to the onslaught of turbulence that continuously goes on in the material world. So, first we want to be situated so we can hear. That involves being in the right ashram. Ashram is a solid foundation by which one can fight maya. So Prabhupada instructed that you situate yourself in whatever ashram, you can make firm strides against the material energy. Whether it's this one or that one, the whole point is to take a proper stance, a strong stance. And then, of course, if you're going to be peaceful in mind, you have to have ample opportunity for devotional service. Because without devotional service, how will the mind be peaceful? You can't make it peaceful on your own. Arjuna himself said that. In the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he said, Chanchalam Himana Krishna. The mind is so flickering, you'd have an easier time trying to stop the raging wind than to try to stop your own mind. Krishna said, that's true, Arjuna, but it is possible to control the mind. So devotional service is our means for controlling the mind. Devotional service includes the holy name. It includes proper attention to the deity. In this way, we can become properly situated and we can hear. And if we're feeling agitation in the mind and disturbed in the mind, we should always look at our situation first. How am I situated in terms of devotional service? Of course, sometimes devotees make the mistake of saying, if I'm feeling disturbed, it's because of devotional service. Anyone who thinks like that, they have not been listening to senior guidance. That's why senior Vaishnavas are there, to point out to you, don't blame devotional service. Let's look at your approach to devotional service. But always, devotional service is a rare privilege, because by devotional service, Krishna himself can be conquered. In fact, in the Nectar of Devotion, it is stated that Krishna does not easily give out opportunities for devotional service, because by service, Krishna can be conquered. So Rupa Goswami says, one of the six characteristics of pure devotional service is that you rarely get a chance for it. Now, how is it that we have a chance? That's because of Lord Chaitanya. So, when you're serving Krishna and you're properly listening to the senior Vaishnavas, when you're properly listening to your spiritual master, when you're probably listening to Prabhupada's books, you realize, I will never blame devotional service. I will simply blame myself for not applying myself properly to that service. But as soon as we start blaming devotional service, then we're literally cutting our own heads off. Because the whole purpose of our existence is to serve Krishna. So if we start blaming that service to Krishna, then what are we supposed to do? You blame devotional service, you'll embrace Maya's service. And you see that happen all the time. The service wasn't right for me. I take shelter of the illusory energy and stay apart, and that way there'll be peace. There won't be any peace. There'll be the mode of ignorance, but there won't be peace, and we should not confuse the mode of ignorance with peace. So, we should always be eager to listen. How can I situate myself properly? What's the right ashram for me? What's the right association for me? What's the right schedule for me? We should be alive with these kind of things. We shouldn't just dull about this. Who am I associating with? Whom am I serving with? What is my schedule? We should together be mulling over these things with each other so that everybody is always properly situated. Once everyone is properly situated, then instructions of how to make advance in spiritual life can be reflected on with concentration. And that is what Krishna is going to do now in the third chapter. Remember, Arjuna started off so distraught. How did he describe himself? My skin is burning. He's confused. He's lost all his composure. He's dropped his bow even. He said firmly, Krishna, I won't fight. I've lost all composure due to weakness. But he did make one right decision amidst that confused, dejected, depressed state. What was that right decision? He said, Krishna, shishyasteham shariman tam prapanyam. In spite of all this confusion, or amidst all this confusion, now I'm your disciple, I'm a soul surrendered unto you, please instruct me. And Krishna was smiling, very happy that a friend had become a disciple. So Krishna immediately began to stabilize Arjuna, explaining you're not the body, explaining the comings and goings of happiness and distress, explaining that Arjuna should be transcendental to the modes of nature, explaining how what is night for the materialist is day for the spiritualist and vice versa, stabilizing him. Just like, you know, mothers who have a child and the child is crying. You have to stabilize the child first, stop the child from crying or a tantrum, and then things can proceed from there. So in the second chapter, Krishna stabilizing Arjuna. Now we'll get to chapter 3, Karma Yoga. And the lessons are really going to start now. But before Krishna can launch into the beginning of transcendental instruction, Arjuna gets put in his words first. Arjuna Uvacha, Jayasi Chet Karmanaste, Mata Bhujir Janardana, Chakim Karmani Gore Mam, Niyojayasi Keshava. Arjuna is interjecting. Now just hold it right here, Krishna. O Janardana, O Keshava, why do you want me to engage in this ghastly warfare? If you think that intelligence is better than fruitive work. In other words, Arjuna is saying, Krishna, you spent the whole chapter telling me I should use my brains, stabilize myself, and not get caught up in the external world, not get caught up in the external body and its happiness and distress. Okay, it sounds great. I just use my intelligence, buddhi, and I just stay apart from everything. That's what you're saying, Krishna. I should just be smart. Understand, happiness and distress is coming and going. The body is changing. Yes, I can see what you mean, Krishna. Yes, I should be aloof from all this. Great, I'm ready to be aloof because I don't want to fight the war. So, well, therefore, since you and I, Krishna, you and I both know that you want me to use my intelligence and be aloof, yes, I'm ready for that. Why in the world would you want me to engage in this ghastly warfare? Arjuna's pulling out all the stops to influence Krishna with his point of view. He's calling his devotional service ghastly. We all might have heard tendencies like this from time to time. You get a service and you... Oh, temple president, why have you engaged me in this ghastly service? I came to Krishna consciousness to develop my intelligence. And yet you want to engage me not only in this ghastly service, but actually any service you want to engage me in is ghastly. We have a lot of problems like that. Arjuna, you should really understand what he's doing here. Krishna wants him to perform a particular service, and Arjuna is calling it ghastly. You are Janardana. You're the Lord in the heart. You're Keshava. You are the Supreme. Why do you want me to fight a war, this ghastly war? Since we both agree that using your brain and being analytical is better than fruitive work, Arjuna is also hinting that the battle of Kurukshetra will be fruitive work, karmic work. Therefore, in this chapter, Krishna is going to lecture him in the difference between karmic work and devotional service. Because Arjuna is calling the battle ghastly and calling it fruitive activity. So he obviously needs some education. So what does Prabhupada say in the purport? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, has very elaborately described the constitution of the soul in the previous chapter, with a view to delivering his intimate friend Arjuna from the ocean of material grief. Certainly everybody knows what the ocean of material grief is like. Certainly we all had some moments when we felt like we were drowning in an ocean of grief. The death of someone in the family, or some disaster, or something which caused us just to become so blue, full of lamentation. So, Krishna has stabilized Arjuna, put him on the shore, got him out of that ocean of material grief. And now what? And the path of realization has been recommended, Buddhi Yoga, or Krishna consciousness. Sometimes Krishna consciousness is misunderstood to be inertia. Do you have any examples of that you've seen sometimes, that people think Krishna consciousness means inertia? People come and take up devotional life and think it means inertia? Inertia means you don't do anything. You just sit down and do nothing. We don't have any cases like that here, though, right? Anyway, Prabhupada is saying here, sometimes Krishna consciousness is misunderstood to be inertia. And one with such a misunderstanding often withdraws to a secluded place to become fully Krishna conscious by chanting the holy name of Lord Krishna. But without being trained in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, it is not advisable to chant the holy name of Krishna in a secluded place, where one may acquire only cheap adoration from the innocent public. So do we have any secluded rooms in this building where where devotees are retiring to? Arjuna also thought of Krishna consciousness or Buddhi Yoga or intelligence in spiritual advancement of knowledge as something like retirement from active life and the practice of penance and austerity at a secluded place. Well, you can sort of see that. Yes, let's get away from the authorities. Let's move way out into who knows where, and there there won't be anybody riding our backs. And in our own way, we'll chant. In our own way, we'll cultivate our Krishna conscious creeper, and in that way there'll be peace. Actually, if someone is mature enough in devotional life, so they can actually ride their own back, that's very good. But we have to be honest. And factually speaking, what we've seen so many times is without senior direction, without veteran guidance, the best made plans go awry. You get out there into the boondocks, full of a little bit of enthusiasm, and as the days and months go by, you sink and sink and sink. And then, generally, everyone's too proud to say anything about it. You know, you make a visit back into the city and see your old Prabhus. Haribo, Prabhu, how you doing? Oh, we're fine out there 200 kilometers away. We're doing fine. You know it's not true, but you just can't tell the truth. So besides the problem of not being able to discipline oneself, of course, if one is actually advanced enough to discipline oneself, be one's own boss, then yes, one can get a lot of service to Krishna done, even though one's on one's own. But generally speaking, we have to be honest and realize the advantages of being where there is good guidance. That'll be another message that Prabhupada will give you in this third chapter. In the third and fifth chapters, the third chapter is called Karma Yoga, the fifth chapter is called Action in Krishna Consciousness. Prabhupada explains that it's actually difficult how to serve Krishna within the material world, how to separate your attempts at enjoyment from giving Krishna pleasure, and therefore guidance is required. So ultimately the point is, if you are living in the temple and not taking guidance, there's no advantage to that. If you're living 300 kilometers from the temple, but you are actively taking guidance, you can still get quite a bit of service done. But if you're living in the temple, building itself, and not taking any guidance, then what's the point? Veteran guidance is a necessity. Why should we reinvent the wheel every year? Year after year, devotees dream up the same old things. You know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. This time, we're going to really get it. And then after the attempt usually dissipates, what's the song they usually sing? This time we almost had it all. Almost, but never getting. Because of lack of guidance. Lack of appreciation of veterans who have seen all these movies again and again and again. So, if you're smart, you're going to want to avoid reinventing the wheel every year. You're going to want to learn all the pitfalls and dangerous curves on the path of rendering devotional service to Krishna. So, Arjuna, for your benefit, he's presenting these various things to Krishna. So you can see what the mind of a conditioned soul is like. Arjuna is going through all this for our benefit, showing you, he's dramatizing all our excuses about devotional service and all the ways we try to avoid Krishna's mercy. So here, once again, Arjuna is using word jugglery, using excuses, how to avoid Krishna's mercy. He doesn't like the service Krishna gave him. That's what Bhagavad Gita means. I don't like the service Krishna gave me. Do you ever think about it that way? That's what's about. The whole book's about that. There's nothing, you know, abstract and high in the sky about Bhagavad Gita. That's why Krishna spoke it on a battlefield, the most non-theoretical place. In the midst of two armies about to kill one another, you can't get more down to earth and practical than that. So that's what we're trying to impress upon people when we meet them about Bhagavad Gita. It's not dogma, rituals, beliefs, theories. It is the most down-to-earth practical book. And for devotees, we should know what Bhagavad Gita is zeroing in on. Bhagavad Gita deals with the complaint, Krishna, I don't like the service you gave me. I don't want to do the service you gave me to do. And it's a lousy service. It's a ghastly service. I don't see anything in it for me, Govinda. Rishikesh, Madhava, Keshava. Arjuna was chanting the holy names, trying to bribe Krishna. Oh, Govinda! Oh, Madhava! how can any good come out of this particular service? So, we learn all these angles just by studying Bhagavad Gita. And having the faith in the Sutta succession that Bhagavad Gita applies to everything. All our questions will be answered by it. So, in other words, Arjuna wanted to skillfully avoid the fighting by using Krishna consciousness as an excuse. But as a sincere student, he placed the matter before his master and questioned Krishna as to his best course of action. In answer, Lord Krishna elaborately explained karma yoga, or work in Krishna consciousness, in this third chapter. So this is what always saves Arjuna. He's mouthing off like this, but he's presenting the matter before Krishna. He's criticizing his devotional service the Lord gave him, calling it ghastly. Yet he is placing the whole issue before Krishna, and therefore Arjuna is rectified. All this drama is going on for our benefit. For our benefit, Krishna has put Arjuna into Maya, actually covered him over, so that Arjuna would genuinely display the mentality of a conditioned soul. All this Krishna has done for our benefit. Taken one of his most intimate devotees and covered him over, so we could see a genuine example of Maya. So, Arjuna goes on to make sure Krishna gets the point here. Vyamishvaneva bhakyena buddha mohaya sivane charetam varanishtitya yena shreya pamapniyam. My intelligence is bewildered by your equivocal instructions. Therefore, please tell me decisively which will be most beneficial for me. Once again, Arjuna is making, he's kicking at Krishna in a very eloquent way. Krishna, he's telling you, you're equivocal means you can understand what someone says in many different ways. It's not clear. So here is Arjuna telling Krishna, you're speaking in a not clear way, but he's doing it in a very humble way. My intelligence is bewildered by your equivocal instruction. In other words, he's seemingly taken the humble position. I'm bewildered, but it's your fault because you're not talking clearly. All this is going on in Bhagavad Gita. You can really see yourself in it. If you approach Bhagavad Gita with humility, you'll see all the different scams going on here. And Arjuna mercifully is demonstrating that. Oh, he's so humble. My intelligence is bewildered. Many times you hear devotees say like that, oh, Prabhu, I'm so fallen. I'm so bewildered. I'm so useless. Because of the service that was given to me, because the instruction wasn't clear, because the instruction did not take into account my circumstances. That kind of humility, you know. So, Arjuna says, therefore, please tell me decisively which will be most beneficial for me, as if Krishna hasn't explained things clearly. Please tell me decisively. In other words, Krishna, make up your mind, get it straight. Because you're not clear, I don't know what to do. It's all your fault. How often we like to blame someone else for our devotional pitfalls. It's very easy to do that. So, in the purport, Prabhupada writes, in the previous chapter, as a prelude to the Bhagavad Gita, many different paths were explained. Such as Sankhya Yoga, Buddha Yoga, control of the senses by intelligence, work without fruit of desire, and the position of the neophyte. This was all presented unsystematically. A more organized outline of the path would be necessary for action and understanding. Arjuna, therefore, wanted to clear up these apparently confusing matters so that any common man could accept them without misinterpretation. Although Krishna had no intention of confusing Arjuna by any jugglery of words, Arjuna could not follow the process of Krishna consciousness, either by inertia or by active service. In other words, by his questions, he is clearing the path of Krishna consciousness for all students who seriously want to understand the mystery of the Bhagavad Gita. So any questions or discussion about this beginning of the third chapter, Karma Yoga? Bear in mind that the standard definition of karma yoga is offering the results of actions to Krishna. Why would you call it karma yoga and not bhakti? Because bhakti means everything for Krishna, whereas, well, that's the perfection of karma yoga. But generally when you say karma yoga, you mean some of the fruits go to Krishna, not all of them. Not only that, but even if you do give all the results to Krishna, you are attached to a particular way of acting. Whereas bhakti means you're not attached to the results and you're not attached to a particular style of action. Therefore, many times, it's very good for devotees, even if they think they have a certain ability, if they're asked to do another kind of service, to do that. Because if they're understanding Bhagavad Gita, they'll know that real bhakti means you're not attached to the results or a particular way of serving Krishna. Of course, if you're engaged according to your propensity, that's always nice. But if we just place ourselves at the disposal of the Lord, that is the quickest way to make spiritual advancement. You can pray, Krishna, you may engage me according to my propensity. You may not. It doesn't matter. I'm your servant unconditionally. That's the royal road to a spiritual happiness. Not that everybody is ready for that. And if they're not ready for that, it doesn't mean we kick them away and beat them over the head with the Bhagavad Gita. there's no doubt that bhakti yoga means not attached to the results or what kind of service you get. That goal may have to be achieved gradually, but that is the goal. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya said, I'm not a brahmana, I'm not a kshatriya, I'm not a vaishya, I'm not a sudra, I'm not a grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, brahmacharya, I'm simply the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna, who is the maintainer of the gopis. That is the classic spiritual position, which we're all trying for according to various speeds. So even if we choose to go a bit slow, at least we should know what the goal is. So any questions? Yes. Yes, that is the purpose of Srila Prabhupada's institutions, to teach bhakti yoga and give it a chance to be performed. There's different degrees of purity of bhakti yoga. When bhakti yoga has its very beginning stages, you can call it karma yoga. Some of the fruits are being sacrificed, or there is great attachment to a particular way of serving Krishna. But as bhakti yoga becomes more and more advanced, then one doesn't become attached to any of the results nor any of the ways of serving Krishna. And when one becomes very advanced, one is simply attached to Krishna's pleasure. That's why Lord Chaitanya prays, you can handle me roughly by your embrace, you can make me brokenhearted by not being present before me, it doesn't matter. That's full-blown bhakti. Any other questions? So the more we can become attuned to Bhagavad Gita and really learn how to become enthused by it, the more others will benefit by our enthusiasm. So at least we can try to make Bhagavad Gita so famous throughout Christ Church so that people will recognize it. Yes, this is one of the classics. I should know all about it. And if I can have a chance to see people who are living according to this book, that's very good. So we have Archie at 7:05, yes. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.